This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 41 was recorded a day early this week on Wednesday, November 30th, 2016, so that we could bring you timely reporting on the OPEC production cut announcement. I'm Eric Townsend. Today's OPEC meeting in Vienna has been the focus of much anticipation as traders have been speculating for weeks on whether or not a production cut deal would really happen. So it's no surprise that oil prices spiked by more than 8% to the upside overnight as OPEC announced a 1.2 million barrel per day production cut. But hold on, that's a cut back down to levels that were actually all-time highs just a few months ago. So how significant is this market-shaking news from OPEC that came out this morning? Fortunately, Aaron saw this coming and predicted that oil would be the hot topic this week. So he booked our favorite crude oil expert, petroleum geologist Art Berman, as this week's featured interview guest. Art and I will discuss the OPEC production cut and much more. Art put together a fantastic slide deck in support of this interview just for Macro Voices listeners. Registered users can find the download link in your research roundup email that you already received. If you're not registered yet, Aaron will tell you how to get the download before the interview starts. We'll also have an important announcement about the future of the Macro Voices podcast after the new year. So please be sure to stay tuned for that right after today's feature interview.
And I'm Aaron Chan. We recorded the show early this week, and our market wrap was taped at about noon Eastern time on Wednesday. So please keep in mind that our commentary won't consider Wednesday afternoon and Thursday's tape action, but as of mid-session Wednesday, S&P futures were trading at 2205 and have obviously broken out of new all-time highs since our last show before the Thanksgiving holiday. S&P futures hit 2211 just after Thanksgiving, then broke out to another all-time high just this morning. The high print so far has been 2213 at about 9 a.m. Eastern time Wednesday. Eric, what's up with equities?
You know, if there's one way I can distinguish myself from other commentators, it's that when I don't know what's going on, I'll admit that rather than making shit up that sounds good. And frankly, I think there's a lot of that going on. So look, the same people who thought that equities would crash on a Trump victory and the same people who never saw the bond market reaction coming, never predicted that, now they're all confidently saying the same thing, which is that this is entirely about inflation expectations and trade policy around the Trump election. In other words, they're making shit up and repeating what other people say because they don't know. So, you know, I was definitely one of the people that got this wrong. I thought equities were going to move the other way on a Trump election. And what I said was that because Trump was so critical of Janet Yellen's artificially low interest rates, that if he was elected, that was going to put a lot of pressure on the Fed's ability to prop up equity markets with low rates. Now, what seems to be happening here is the market is interpreting part of that, which is the Trump win means no more artificially low interest rates, and that's leading to a sharp bond sell-off, or at least I think that that is the reason for this to be happening. For sure, inflation expectations are spiking, but you know, I think that's a herd mentality thing, and I think that time will tell whether or not that trend continues or not. We don't know if the Trump election is bullish for stocks meme that we've seen since the election is going to last or not. If anything, I would say timing's about right. You know, we're coming up on almost a month since the election. If this was a false move and it's going to actually reverse to the downside, as some people have suggested, we should be watching for that to maybe begin. But you know, as far as I'm concerned, I got the call wrong on what equities were going to do. I can't explain this. I'm not going to jump on board with this same story everybody else is telling about how it's entirely about trade policy driving inflation expectations. I don't think anybody really knows for sure exactly what is driving this market. So I'm on the sidelines. I think that the recession scenario We're definitely overdue for that. I think the equity correction is overdue and coming before 2017 is out. But, you know, does it start before 2016 is out? I don't know. I'm just sitting on the sidelines waiting to see what happens next.
All right, we'll wait and see. Before we move on to crude oil, let's start with the U.S. dollar index, which traded as high as 102.12 just before the Thanksgiving holiday, a new 13-year high. So far, Eric, your dollar bullish scenario is definitely still playing out. Any updates on your dollar index outlook?
Well, you know, I think it is still on. If anything, I wish that I had been a little more aggressive. I am long U.S. dollar index futures. I've been looking for a pullback as an opportunity to add to that position. Probably saw that yesterday when we saw a pullback down to 101, or actually below 101 to a 100 handle. And I thought maybe it had lower to go, and I was waiting for a sign of a bottom there, and I probably missed it because we're back to 101 spot 56, and I wouldn't be surprised if we're back above 102 in the next few days here. Of course, there are things on the horizon, like the Italian referendum, that are definitely going to affect the trade. But my general feeling is that the secular upward move in the dollar index is back on. And I think 103 is probably going to be a resistance level. And then once we break through that, 110 comes into view. So I think it's up and away from here on the dollar index.
This is where we normally cover crude oil, but obviously our whole show this week is going to be dedicated to that subject. So, Eric, is there anything you want to cover now on crude oil before we move on to gold?
Yeah, when I taped the interview with Art, the crude oil inventory numbers had not come out yet. Wednesday morning's 10:30 inventory release wasn't there, so we were not able to include that. I want to cover that now, but I'm going to leave the rest of the subject of oil for the feature interview with Art. So after that interview was taped, we did get our inventory numbers, 884,000 barrel drawdown on national crude oil inventories, a little bit bigger than of a drawdown than expected, but totally offset by across-the-board builds on everything else. Cushing, Oklahoma, 2.4 million barrel build on inventory, way above expectations. Gasoline, 2.1 million barrel build on inventory. Distillates, huge, just enormous, 5 million barrel build on distillate inventories in 1 week. Now, normally, all of these very large builds on inventory would be bearish for oil prices. But of course, it's all about OPEC this week. As we're recording here, mid-session on Wednesday, 49 spot 37 was the high. We're back up to 49 spot 25 as I'm speaking right now. I wouldn't be surprised if we see 50 in the next day or so, because there's all of this enthusiasm. I think some of that enthusiasm is misplaced. I think Art agrees with me, but let's save that part for the feature interview coming up with Art Berman.
Great. Well, gold broke below the psychologically important 1200 level since our last show. What's going on with the yellow metal?
Well, recall my thesis from the last show, which is I think a December rate hike is almost a certainty. And I think that that could potentially be a low point for gold. Maybe, maybe not. Some people think that gold has much lower to go here. So I'm watching it closely. 1180 has been a key level in the last cycle. So it's kind of important to see whether 1180 holds or not. Looks like maybe it's not going to. We've seen a couple of prints well below that on an intraday basis. 1170 spot 30 looks like it was the low print so far. That was several days ago. This morning we saw 1171 spot 30. We're back up to 1176 as we're recording just after noon in New York on Wednesday afternoon. So where are we going to see a close below 1180, and will it hold below 1180? That's going to be significant. What's driving all this? You've said, you know, hey, if inflation expectations are spiking, shouldn't that be good for gold? The answer is a lot of people will think that treasury yields are headed much higher and therefore bond prices much lower. Remember that treasuries are effectively gold's competitor. So if the yield on treasuries is expected to increase, that makes treasuries a more attractive alternative relative to gold. And that kind of explains the conundrum with how could it be that even in the face of rising inflation expectations, there is still downside pressure on gold. The answer is if you expect much higher treasury yields, then gold has competition in terms of another safe haven asset. At least in the eyes of most people, they consider treasuries to be just as safe as gold, although I would personally disagree with that. That's kind of the consensus view. So how do you reconcile this? Well, the real answer is it's not about treasury yields. It's about real interest rates, which means take the treasury yield and subtract inflation from it. And that really is the number that gold has to compete with because gold can't deliver any yield. But it does keep up with inflation. So in order to have an outlook for what real interest rates are going to be, you've got to have an outlook for inflation expectations. And I really think that that outlook is blurred by crowd psychology. Definitely the expectation right now is that there is a massive, massive spike in inflation expectations. It's because all of the commentators on the cable networks are saying that that's true. And, you know, the herd is running in that direction right now. Whether or not Donald Trump's trade policy is really going to lead to a secular increase in inflation and therefore inflation expectations, as far as I'm concerned, the jury's still out. Looks like that's the direction right now, but it remains to be seen. So what happens for gold from here, I think will have a lot to do with real interest rate expectations, and I think it's a moving target.
And finally, 10-year treasury yields are still quite elevated, 2.38 as of mid-session Wednesday. So what's going on with fixed income?
This is definitely a result that is in reaction to the election of Donald Trump. But whether you say that spiking inflation expectations or the other description that I gave a minute ago, which is just that this is about Trump being so critical of the Fed that they're not going to be able to get away with artificially suppressing interest rates, and it's about Fed policy as opposed to inflation expectations. Those are two different explanations for the same thing. Which one is right? I don't know. I don't think anybody knows. But my point is simply that this mainstream media, everybody is so confidently telling the same story now. They're making shit up because it sounds good, and they're copying what other people are saying because they don't know, and I don't think anybody really knows. We need to watch the market and let the market tell us what this means. Technicians are saying the next target is around 2.5%. A note out from Goldman this week says that 10-year yields above 2.75% or so is where they would start to really present a serious headwind that might get in the way of this equity rally. So Goldman thinks the equity rally can continue until we get above 2.75 on the 10-year yield. As you said, we're still at actually 239 as we're speaking just afternoon on Wednesday afternoon. I'd really like to get Raoul Paul's take on this because he's been a very outspoken person to say that we still are going to see sub 1% 10-year yields before this thing is over. Raoul said that before the election, though. I'd love to get an update. So, you know, if you can book him for a short interview in the next couple of weeks, that would be awesome.
All right, Eric, I'll see what I can do. Thanks for the market update. Petroleum geologist Art Berman has been one of our most popular guests, so we brought him back to cover today's OPEC production cut announcement and for a general update on energy markets. Mr. Berman prepared a slide deck just for this interview, and we strongly encourage you to download it as Eric and Art will be discussing it in the interview. Registered users already received the download link in our Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to macrovoices.com, click the red subscribe for free button at the top right corner of the page, then click register your free Macro Voices account near the bottom of the page. Registration is free and only takes a couple of minutes. Once you're registered and logged in, click the Research Library function on the black menu bar, then click Guest Publications. You'll see the download link for Art Berman's slide deck at the top of the list. Eric's interview with Mr. Berman is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is petroleum geologist Art Berman, one of our most popular guests ever. Art has prepared a slide deck for this discussion. For any of you who fast forwarded to this point and skipped where Aaron told you how to get the download, don't send me an email angrily saying that there was no instructions. Go back and listen. We told you before the interview started where to get the download. So with that covered out of the way, before we can even get to the slide deck, Art, the story and the world has changed since it was prepared last night, because of course this morning OPEC finally agreed to cut production by 1.2 million barrels per day, and that sent oil futures up more than 8% overnight from last close on Tuesday afternoon. But I want to make sure we put this in context. That's a 1.2 million barrel cut all the way down to 32.5 million barrels per day, which was an all-time record high level just a few months ago. So this production cut is really just going back to where we were as a new all-time high, less than a year ago. So what's your take before we get into the slide deck, Art, on the news out of OPEC this morning?
Right, Eric. Well, it's of course it's anyone's guess, but my take is that they had to deliver something at this meeting, because if they didn't, the bottom was going to drop out of oil prices. I mean, they've been doing this dance now for what, since February, mid-February of this year, and there's no material reason for oil prices to be in the mid-40s, although it's a perfectly fine price as far as yield curves and inventories and all that go. But realistically, there's no reason why it should be 45 as opposed to 40 as opposed to 35, since it's been in that territory for some time. So my sense is that this agreement was more about a floor than a ceiling, that the internal negotiations and discussions were something like, you know, if we don't deliver something, the bottom's going to drop out of this market, and then we're really going to be hurting. So we got to give them something. We can worry about the details. And of course, with OPEC, the talk is great, but let's actually see how the execution works. Let's see the action. And of course, none of that's happened. So what do we know? We know what people have murmured, that, you know, something like half the cut, half a million barrels, is going to come from Saudi Arabia, supposedly. Somebody said that almost the rest of it is going to come from Russia, 400,000 barrels a day. Russia said, we think that's excessive. So in other words, we don't know anything. We don't know anything more than we knew last night. And if we would have had this interview last night, I would have told you, I guarantee they're going to come up with something. They're going to cut something because they have to. So in a way, what's occurred is not not really news for me. It's obviously news for the world, and that's great. And prices have responded, but in a way, maybe not even so much. I mean, they've gone up a couple of bucks, but to that extent, I mean, an awful lot of this cut has been priced into the market for how long? And like you say, the level that they're cutting to is not exactly something that's going to restructure the oil market. So that's my early take. And of course, I don't think anybody knows anything more than I just told you right now. And if you do, tell me, because I'd love to know about it.
Well, and I should point out for our listeners, too, that we're speaking before the inventory numbers even came out on Wednesday morning at 10:30. By the end of this interview, those numbers will have come out, and we'll have a chance to discuss them. But as we're speaking right now, I'm looking at 49.26. That's about 8.5% up from yesterday's close. So it's a significant move, but, you know, it's back up to where it was a few weeks ago. It's still well below, though. Was it 52.22 was the high on this cycle from, I guess it was about 6-8 weeks ago. So with that, let's move on, I think, to the first point in your slide deck, page 2, which is that you say OPEC really can't fix the problem of low oil prices anyway. I think you've alluded to some of that. But why don't you go ahead and start to walk us through what you've got in this presentation for us?
Sure. the premise that I come from, and don't get me wrong, I'm not at all opposed to higher oil prices. In fact, they would work very well for me personally. My business is drilling wells, producing oil, so I it would be great if we had higher oil prices. But I am skeptical because my foundation is always in fundamentals, and we know that fundamentals don't always rule the market. But in this particular case, I mean, sentiment has really ruled the market more than anything else for most of the time since oil prices collapsed, 2+ years ago. But so the premise is that, okay, OPEC's going to cut supposedly 1.2 million barrels. That's great. But what's that going to accomplish? And the key points I want to cover are, first of all, cutting production. The idea is to bring the market into balance. We've heard how many times that there's this horrible glut, this unbelievable oversupply of oil. Well, not really. I mean, if you look at the data, we're something like 250,000 barrels a day above market balance, just taking production minus consumption, and it's been that way for 6 months. Now, the market doesn't get any closer to balance than that. The notion of an equilibrium oil market is, well, it exists only in the minds of men. As long as you've got storage, there it is a disequilibrium system. And in previous posts I've done, I looked at when the market has been within 250,000 barrels plus or minus, and what are the prices that you get, and you get any price you want. I mean, there's nothing magic about market balance, but the fact is we're effectively in market balance. So what's a cut going to accomplish? I mean, that would be the main purpose of the cut. The second point, and it's related to the first, is we got way too much oil in storage. And people somehow think about market balance as production minus consumption, but storage is a big part of both supply and demand because it is a disequilibrium system that you almost never have available everything you need, which is why every week we look at the inventory numbers to see how much was added to storage or how much came out of storage, and that's why it affects the price as much as it does. Third point is supply is what everyone's focused on, and that's great. But what about demand? And the truth is that demand growth is very weak. Now, that doesn't mean we don't have demand. It's demand growth, the rate at which demand increases. And we're way below the average for the last 4 years or 6 years or 8 years. And so that's a problem going forward, that why is demand growth as weak as it is? And we'll talk about that. The fourth point is U.S. production started increasing again before any of this happened. The last couple of months, we've had it sputtering around, going up a little bit, going down a little bit. But the decline in U.S. production is over, and EIA has been forecasting this for a while. The rig counts are way up from where they were in mid-year, and gosh, you know, you drill more wells, you produce more oil. And the U.S. is the prime offender when it comes to the imbalance in the market. We want to blame OPEC, but as we'll see when we get into the deck, it's the U.S. that's the biggest part of the problem. And there are some OPEC members that are problematic, like Iraq mainly, and Iran more recently. The second to last point is the press wants to tell us that OPEC is desperate for higher prices. Well, what's the basis of that? And don't get me wrong, just like me, they would love to have higher prices. There's no doubt about it. But how do we define desperate? How do we measure desperate? And if we look at the foreign exchange reserve accounts, the reality is that the principal members of OPEC that control so much of the production, I don't see a case for the fact that they're desperate, and certainly not Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is way down on their cash reserves, but they're way above any year previous to 2010. So comparatively speaking, they're fine. And then finally, it's the economy, stupid. The answer to all of these questions, all of the five previous points, is that we've got a super weak, fragile global economy. And a price, production cut is nice, but it's not going to fix the weakness in the global economy. We've got an economy that's burdened by debt, and low oil prices are really a response to that fundamental underlying weakness. So that's where I came from last night before the cut was announced, and sitting here this morning after the cut was announced. First of all, let's wait and see what action is in fact taken beyond words. And second, back to the points that I made, it's hard for me to see that this is going to fix low oil prices beyond the initial buzz that we're seeing right now.
So going back then to your first point, that was an excellent summary, by the way. So we'll drill down now on each one of those points. Your first point was the market is already in balance. And we should point out for any listeners who don't follow this closely that for sure the market was dramatically oversupplied with too much oil to the tune of at least 2 million barrels a day. But as your graph on slide 3 here shows, that's history now. That's something that happened a year and a half ago, and it hasn't been true, as you say, for 6 months. What else can you tell us on this next slide here?
Well, as I said in my introduction, market balance is a human construct. It's an illusion that balance particularly accomplishes anything. And the notion of equilibrium in a commodity market for me is just bizarre. that exists only in economic theory. And so the important point and the important issue is if you accept what I'm saying, that 0.25 million barrels a day is about as close to balance as you ever get, then why haven't prices responded more than they have? And I would argue, and if you look at graph 2, you can see that prices have moved up somewhat from low 40s to mid 40s, as we know, and if you didn't know anything else, you could say, oh, well, that's in response to approaching market balance. And I'd say, well, maybe, or at least approaching market balance isn't a negative, but I think most of that has to do with a couple of things. First, everybody's desperately waiting for an OPEC production cut. It's market sentiment that's been buoying up the price of oil. And importantly, we've had some very anomalous withdrawals or reported withdrawals from U.S. storage since the beginning of September that, we can talk about, are they even real? But whatever, we've seen some very peculiar behavior in U.S. inventories, which the market has responded to generally more positively than negatively. So that's the problem. The problem is that you would expect prices to be higher or at least more stable than they have been if, in fact, market balance oversupply is the issue. And I think you nailed it, Eric, and that is that this thing all started back in, well, it really started in January of 2014 when we started to see this imbalance. But the initial symptom, the superficial reason, was way too much oil being produced relative to demand or consumption. That largely got fixed. 2015 was a pretty bad year for oversupply, but towards the end of 2015, prices got low enough. They got below $30. Strange as it sounds, market discipline de facto has gone into effect. People are drilling better wells or better locations. They've cut a lot of staff. They've cut a lot of costs. They've hammered the service industry prices way down. So it's, you know, there's an efficiency that has come into the market. So that's really the issue.
Hang on just a second, Art. I want to go back to this issue about oversupply, because the level that OPEC just announced that they would cut down to, that's 32.5 million barrels per day, they had never, ever in history produced that much oil back when the market was oversupplied dramatically. So clearly, you know, OPEC has just been increasing production. It's not like OPEC has solved the problem by anything they've done. So is it all coming out of U.S. production? Has that been the reason that we have gotten away from this 2 million barrel a day oversupply, or is it something else? What has solved the problem?
Tough question. U.S. production has fallen by 1 million barrels a day. So U.S. production is certainly a big component of it. The other piece is that in 2015, demand went way up. I mean, we had demand growth at 2.5 million barrels a day in response to lower prices. So it always works on both sides of the disequilibrium. Lower production and higher demand in response to lower prices. So, you know, it's difficult in any given month to account for all the pluses and minuses in the equation. So, but I think that, you know, the big components are those principally. U.S., Canada to a lesser extent. Canada's production is kind of more inelastic, if you will, because the oil sands are the major component, and once you start getting those online, you don't turn them off the way you can with shale wells in the U.S.
And going back to your next point, which is too much oil in storage, you know, for you and I, we're both concerned that we might be getting to the point where Cushing, Oklahoma could run out of space. And it seems like that problem is pretty much abated now. What else can you tell us about what's going on with the storage picture?
Well, I think the storage picture is fluid. It's very dynamic, and obviously the Cushing story is that there's been a considerable amount of takeaway capacity that's been added through mainly through pipeline reversals. So Cushing a year ago or so seemed to be the key to everything for me, understanding you know, price response, and it's become less so. Now overall inventories and comparative inventories absolutely rule, but it's become more of a shell game to understand, you know, is it Cushing, is it Cushing plus Gulf Coast, or is it total U.S. Stocks? And more recently, it's become more of an issue of total U.S. stocks. I think there's some misperceptions about what exactly is our crude oil capacity. And you know, we tend to think of that as, you know, that we've been teetering on the edge of maxing out, and the reality is that there's more. That if you actually dissect the EIA numbers, you find that they're, you know, that it's not quite as critical as we thought. But mainly the issue for storage for me has become much more of an issue of imports than it has U.S. production. That as I look at fluctuating storage volumes on a weekly basis, it's almost always, production is has been sort of slowly declining, but it doesn't have that much variability on a weekly basis. It's imports, and so why are we importing so much oil? And I think the answer is very straightforward, and that is that we've got to import the heavier oil to blend with our ultra light that's come to dominate U.S. production. We simply can't refine the amount of oil that we're producing, even at a lower level. And so the only way to deal with it is to bring in heavier oil to mix with it. And that's a side of the story that I don't think has really surfaced very strongly, except a year or so ago when there was a lot of movement to repeal the crude oil export ban, which was done, and incidentally, it didn't accomplish hardly anything in terms of increasing U.S. exports, and it hasn't solved the problem of too much ultralight oil. So that's a quick summary of a sort of complicated story.
Let's move on to your next point, which was demand growth is weak. What's the story, and what can you tell us about the graph on page five of your slide deck here?
Well, it's all got to do with affordability, Eric. I mean, I think that's the big issue that's emerging here for me, and that is that our demand, our willingness to spend money on energy in general, is extremely price sensitive since the financial collapse back in 2008. But I think you can trace it back even farther. So it's a little bit like the ads you see on television for it's Ford Truck Month. You don't think you can afford a new truck, but let's show you how that's not really true. That you don't make any payments for 5 years, and you don't have any interest for 7 years. And we write you a loan for 8 or 9 years. So, rest assured, you can afford it. So it's all about debt. And so we've pushed so much of our economy into the realm of debt. Let's pay for what we need or what we want today, and we'll worry about how we pay it off later. And I think what 2008 showed was you can't push it any farther. That the economy, the world economy, is maxed out on debt, and that has had a pronounced effect on people's willingness to spend money. You remember, George W. Bush, right after the financial collapse, trying to cajole people into going out and shopping, spend some money, guys. And of course, the central bank's efforts, not only in the U.S., but elsewhere, certainly in the developed countries, has been to try to get people to spend money, try to increase the so-called velocity of money. And it hasn't been very effective, no matter what we've done. So demand for everything is weak because people are maxed out on their ability to meet debt service. You give them a little extra money, cars for clunkers or whatever, and what do? They pay down debt, or they save money, and they don't go out and buy the Ford trucks. They don't go out and refinance their homes. They don't go out and buy new furniture the way that we used to, because we can't. So this is a huge problem that is certainly not exclusive to crude oil.
Next topic, of course, is that U.S. production has started increasing. And I'd really like, because you're in this business, Art, to get your perspective not only on what's happened, but what you're hearing and what the sentiment is in terms of your customers. Is everybody gung-ho and saying, okay, look, this thing's over, it's time to ramp up and drill as many oil wells as we can? Or is it a wait-and-see thing? Or is it about hedging? Or what's going on?
That's a really good question, Eric. It's a race to the bottom is what it is. What's happened is that the investors, the capital providers, and have concluded with all of the problems in the U.S. oil industry, the bankruptcies, et cetera, that they've got to be more selective. And the Permian Basin in West Texas and southeastern New Mexico has emerged as the preferred group of survivor companies and oil supply for the United States. And so the Bakken and the Eagle Ford, which were all the rage a year or two or three ago, those are less favored basins these days, plays, if you will. not to say that they've been abandoned, but those are, you know, as far as the capital providers, the investors, they're saying, you know, we need to greatly reduce the number of companies and plays that we're going to put our money in. It doesn't mean there's any less money going. Eagle Ford is basically, I won't say it's dead, but it's lost huge momentum. It's way out of favor. Bakken, not so, you know, it's kind of lukewarm. The Permian is the great hope. This is, you know, I've written a post called Saudi Permian. And of course, just a week ago, we had this crazy news barrage about how there's some new U.S. Geological Survey study says that the Permian Basin's got 20 billion barrels of resources, and all of a sudden, you know, people are beating their chests about how we don't need Saudi Arabia anymore. We're on our way to energy independence. We see this kind of nonsense. It emerges from time to time. So the story is that the Permian Basin it now accounts for 65% of the U.S. Rig count, total rig count. It's crazy. And people are spending upwards of $60,000 an acre for leases, for land in the Permian Basin. I've never seen anything that even remotely parallels this in my almost 40 years in the oil and gas business. A couple of years ago, when shale gas was going berserk, we saw $30,000 an acre in the Haynesville shale. And we're talking double that right now. So this is a rush. This is an absolute oil rush, gold rush kind of phenomenon. So it's all focused in one place. And the thinking is, these plays are actually commercial at current prices, which is only true if you exclude a whole lot of costs and play around with the numbers. But that's the deal. But the Permian, let's not sell it short. There's something like 2 million barrels a day of production that increased just since 2010. Probably 60 or 70% of that is from three plays that all have to do with horizontal drilling and hydraulic fracturing. They're not shales for the most part, but we're not going to split hairs. And this is a basin that, it's been producing oil for over 100 years. I mean, it's got a great petroleum system, a lot of relatively little wells, but you put them all together and it does produce a fair amount. So that's where things are going. Happy days are not here again. But if you're in the Permian Basin, it's boom times, and things are going berserk out there. If you're in the Bakken, it's okay. If you're in the Eagle Ford, not so good.
Your next point is OPEC is not as desperate as many people believe for higher prices. I'd like you to comment on that, but specifically on the difference between different countries, because one thing I've read a lot about recently is just Venezuela is really in trouble, and that situation may have its roots in other things besides oil prices, but it sounds like without a significant recovery in oil prices, that country could fall apart. And I tend to think in terms of, okay, what does that mean in terms of reflexivity? When that happens, if Venezuela is going to fall apart, if there's not a significant increase in oil prices, which neither you or I see coming, well, that means a bunch of supply is likely to come offline at some point if somebody doesn't bail them out. And so how does that play into the whole picture? So could you just comment in general, but particularly on that point?
Yeah, Venezuela is a mess. I mean, there's just no doubt about it. And Venezuela has been a mess for the better part of this century. High oil prices with the exception of the financial crisis from about 2005 through mid-2014 bailed them out of a lot of hurtful situations. But they had a populist ruler, this Chavez guy, who basically took a lot of that oil money and just gave it to people to buy their votes. He was selling oil to Cuba until very recently for almost as low a price as he was subsidizing it for his own people. And so Venezuela, under Chavez, he basically destroyed their national oil company, PDVSA. He fired most of their competent technical people. Production was faltering, even at high oil prices, just based on mismanagement and incompetence. So the seeds of what we're seeing in Venezuela were sown a long time ago. And of course, the United States and Venezuela have been at each other's throats politically and economically for way back into the Bush administration, certainly. So Venezuela has, I think, high potential for becoming a failed state. And what are the implications of that? Venezuela has huge reserves. Most of those reserves are heavy oil, oil sands, if you will, and that's not... So the reserves and their production, there's a big gap between them. But the United States imports a reasonable amount of oil from Venezuela, and if they were to go offline entirely, that would be a big problem for the world. Now, what you can see in the chart, the right hand chart in slide 7. Is that this is happening in sort of a gradual way that Venezuela's production has been tapering, and my guess is that we probably won't see a catastrophic ending of production, because the government there will that's going to be the resource of last recourse. That's their only real source of revenue. So they're going to find ways, I think, to keep production from absolutely cratering, but I expect it's going to continue to decline. So I don't see that as necessarily being a cause for more concern than we've seen for the last certainly 6 months or 18 months. But it could develop. I mean, popular unrest, if they actually end up losing control of the state, then that's going to have an effect on oil production. So Venezuela is a special case. Nigeria, their production's way down, mainly because the government stopped paying off the rebels who are bombing pipelines and causing a lot of disruption in the Niger Delta. I don't quite know why they haven't just decided to resume payments to those guys, and I expect that will happen at some time fairly soon. But Nigeria certainly has the potential to increase its production by 500,000 barrels a day very quickly if they just if they just do what they need to do in the Niger Delta region. And then Libya is the other country that has upwards to 1 million barrels of capacity that has been effectively on, off, to varying degrees since they ran into civil unrest there back in 2010, 2011. So what I'm saying, Eric, is that I'm very concerned about Venezuela, as you are. Don't get me wrong. I don't in any way mean to diminish the potential for disruption of the oil market in Venezuela. But I also see that certainly Nigeria, Libya have good potential, and there's reason to expect that we're going to see some of that made up. And of course, then there's Iran that's come on very strong with 800,000 plus barrels of oil production that wasn't there in last November. So, with OPEC, with these funny countries, that are so dependent on oil, there's always offs and ons, compensating production, and that's what we've always seen. And Venezuela, like I say, is extreme, but there are these compensating aspects.
Going back to Saudi Arabia and the other countries that have more pull in terms of OPEC's decisions, I hear a lot of people, a lot of traders saying, "Okay, look, we've got the first production cut. Probably more production cuts are coming, because obviously this was just a token production cut, cutting down to a level that was an all-time record high just a few months ago." As far as substantive cuts that would actually cause some of these predictions of $75, $85, $95 oil prices. I'm having a hard time putting that one together, Art, because from what you're saying, it sounds like the OPEC needs to continue having token cuts if that's what it takes to keep prices around $50 a barrel. But the argument for why they would have to make a substantial cut that would actually push prices back up, you know, would draw down from all this oil and storage and push prices back above $80 a barrel, I'm not really seeing the logic for why they would do that. Do you see it differently?
No, I see it the same, Eric, and I think it's so. On the one hand, I'm saying that let's just talk Saudi Arabia for a moment and look at the graph on the left of slide 7. I mean, that's basically their cash reserve, and sure, it's way down. I mean, they've burned through almost $220 billion since this oil price collapse began, and you can make much of that if you like, but relative to previous levels of cash reserves, they're still above every year before 2010. They got a lot of money in reserve. They're not running out of cash, and they've got twice as much as the United States does in cash reserves. Not that that should be particularly comforting, but that's the reality of the situation. My sense is that look, this debt thing and these budgetary issues affect everyone. They affect companies and they affect countries. And whether you're Saudi Arabia, who is in relatively better shape than much of the rest of OPEC, or if you're Venezuela, I mean, you got to have cash flow, and countries and companies, whether they're shale companies in the U.S. or whoever, they're gonna produce oil at a loss to generate cash flow, to keep the lights on, to maintain their debt service, and et cetera. And that's just, that's the reality. So how much, I say on the one hand that OPEC's not desperate, but the fact that it's taken them so long to put this cut together, and the fact that they couldn't deliver on a freeze, to me speaks volumes about how important cash flow is to the maintenance of some kind of equilibrium in terms of fiscal budgeting. So I don't see a lot of appetite for successive cuts, especially when you look at the other side of the equation, which is going to be increased U.S. production. Let's not forget that it was mostly U.S. overproduction that at least precipitated this oil price collapse back in 2014. And there, I think it's more than fair to say that if there was, in fact, a Saudi strategy to try to stem the flow of capital to the unconventional oil sector, not just U.S., but oil sands in Canada, deep water, et cetera, it has not been very effective. In fact, it hasn't been effective at all on U.S. unconventional production. Been more effective on the oil sands, more effective on the deep water, but the appetite for investors, capital providers, to keep funneling money into the shale plays, it just hasn't happened. They haven't stopped. And so, at some point, assuming that was their strategy, and we don't know, that's failed. So the other thing you have to look at is Saudi's in the middle of a huge shift in their culture and their economic focus. They've got a young prince who's sort of running the show over there, this Mohammed bin Salman. And the idea is to try to diversify their economy. We keep hearing about an IPO for Saudi Aramco, which I think is very real. And so the controversy and the debate is, well, how to value Saudi Aramco? And if oil prices are not at some respectable level, whatever that is, then those reserves, their value drops, and they can't raise money. So I'm saying, you know, for Saudi, their focus is perhaps a year in the future to when this IPO for Saudi Aramco occurs. And so I think that, again, going back to my initial comments, this agreement, this production cut, I think was about a floor and not a ceiling. Whether or not they can move towards a higher price. I mean, $70 oil, I don't see any technical way to get to $70 oil until, you know, going back to, you know, to slide four. I mean, we've got to go through at least 350 million barrels of OECD, advanced nation, liquids storage before we have any possibility of getting there. And as I say in that slide, you know, that's the equivalent of almost 1.5 million barrels a day for a year, just that's coming out of storage. So it's just very, very difficult for me to see what has to happen to get to $70 or $80. I'm not saying it's impossible, but the only way I see it is by major outages, and of course Venezuela is one that we can talk about. But you know, we're talking about civil unrest, wars, that kind of thing that could cause a production deficit, an outage sufficient to actually cause supplies to become tight. But we still got to work through that storage, and that's going to take a long time.
Unfortunately, we've only got a few minutes left, so let's touch briefly on your final point, the economy, stupid.
Yeah, we just don't want to look at what's happened to our economy. And I, of course, see it very much related to the cost of energy. And so we had these huge dislocations, huge increases in the price of oil back in the mid-70s through the mid-80s, and that just resulted in a fundamental restructuring of the global economy, because the economy runs on energy. We've talked about this before. I can't say it enough times. Energy is the economy. Money is a call on energy. And what we've done, what we certainly in the U.S., who, you know, it's not all about the U.S., but it's a lot about the U.S. as the leader of the world economy. The way that Ronald Reagan and some of his successors, all of his successors, the way they dealt with the impact of those elevated energy costs was through debt. Okay, and so we look fondly back on the Ronald Reagan days and Make America Great. Well, what Ronald Reagan did, among other things, was he got us really on the debt wagon, and so now we've gotten to a point where our debt, it exceeded GDP, gross domestic product, right after that period of oil shocks, and it hadn't gotten any better. It's gotten worse. GDP growth has been declining since just after that initial oil shock, and then we got another big one that, you know, that just burst here a couple of years ago. So we've got a situation where we have economists and politicians scratching their heads and trying to say, why can't we recover the economy? What's happened to growth? And the answer is, the cost of doing business has increased tremendously, and that's the cost of energy, which for the most part is the cost of oil. And even at today's depressed oil prices, we are still 40% higher constant dollar 2016 oil prices than we had from 1986 to 2003. And I just don't know of any business that I've ever been in or been associated with that can stand a 40% increase in their underlying cost of doing business and still grow. maybe organized crime, I don't know. But that's the problem, that we've just gotten ourselves into a U.S. and a global situation of debt dependency that has now come due. And the financial crisis should have been a wake-up call. We solved that problem of too much debt with more debt. So to me, the, you know, the energy debt, global economy, oil price situation that we're talking about, they're all a common topic, really.
Art, I had hoped that we would be able to not only get into your conclusions slide, which I think is pretty self-explanatory here, but also really talk in detail about inventory. Inventory numbers have come out while we've been talking. Unfortunately, we're really up against our time limit. What I do want to mention is you've got a really interesting theory that a lot of these inventory numbers that the government's reporting may actually be wrong because of some accounting funkiness that's going on there. You've got an excellent blog post that goes into that in detail. We're going to have a link to that blog post in this week's research roundup that our registered users will be able to find. Give us just the 1 to 2 minute very quick summary of what they can find there before we close.
Sure, Eric. It's pretty straightforward. I mean, there are some inputs and outputs. Production net imports are the inputs, and refinery runs are the outputs. And the EIA provides all that data on a weekly or monthly basis. And if you add all those, you know, the pluses and the minuses, you ought to get inventory change. And what we found is that you don't. And that the government, the EIA has these, they've got these fudge factors that they introduce to try to make everything work out on the assumption that inventory is correct. Our conclusion is that there's something like a 350, 400 million barrel discrepancy between reported stocks since about 2002 and what you get for, you know, what they ought to be based on the same inputs that EIA provides. So we could have a whole lot less oil in storage than I think, if all that's true. Point being that there's huge uncertainty, and so the assumption is that we know how much oil is in storage, and the truth is that it's based on a sampling algorithm, and nobody ever goes out there, at least the EIA doesn't, and measure what's in the tanks and the underground storage. So I'm not saying, you know, I'm not ringing an alarm bell here. I'm just saying there's huge uncertainty, and I've been in discussions with the deputy administrator, the second in charge of the EIA, who basically thinks that I'm out to lunch on this, but I continue to talk about it because the numbers just don't add up.
Okay. Unfortunately, we do have to leave it there. We've actually run a bit over time, although it was worth it to get your perspective. I know you've always been one of our favorite guests on the program, so thank you so much for a great interview. For anyone who's not familiar with Art's work, the blog is artberman.com. Art also writes for Forbes, has a blog there. Subscribing to artberman.com, I think, is just a no-brainer. It's fantastic content. We do have links to that in your research roundup, and we're going to have to leave it there, folks. Aaron Chan and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Congratulations on another great interview, Eric. I always enjoy listening to Art Berman.
Well, congratulations are definitely in order, but for you, not for me, because you have accepted a full-time job in finance. So congratulations. And I, for one, am proud to say that your excellent work here on the Macro Voices podcast probably helped open the door for you to really launch your career with what sounds to me like an absolutely outstanding opportunity.
Well, thanks a lot, Eric. I'm really excited about the new job, but unfortunately, I'm going to have to stay mum on the subject for now, but suffice it to say that it's a strategic career shift for me, and I couldn't be more excited about it. But what I can say, though, is that Macro Voices was an instrumental part of my securing this new role, and I wanted to personally thank you for the opportunity to co-host alongside you, Eric. It's been a lot of fun, but it's also bittersweet now that I'm forced to leave Macro Voices in order to focus on my new role.
Fortunately for both of us, I know the guy that you're going to work for personally, and he's one of the few true gentlemen in this business. He knew that hiring you would put me in a bind, so he very graciously went well beyond the call of duty and agreed to allow you to continue hosting the show while I recruit a new producer and co-host. So if you are listening, sir, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for your gesture of courtesy. But that said, you're right, Aaron, I'm about to lose you, so I need to start looking for your replacement. But before we get into the details of that, I want to first publicly thank you for all of your excellent work to date. This show would never have been possible without all the hard work that Nathan Egger put into helping me design the format and serving as my first producer and co-host. Likewise, we never could have achieved the growth that we've seen since then without all of your hard work. So I hope our listeners will join me in thanking both Nathan and Aaron for their amazing contributions. I could never have done this without you guys. So thanks so much. But now, as you say, it is time to let our listeners know that I'm interested in hearing from anyone who might enjoy being our third producer and co-host. But you can't know whether or not you might be interested in that until you know actually what it entails. So Aaron is far better qualified than I am to describe what his own job is. So Aaron, please tell our listeners exactly what it is that you do for Macro Voices.
Well, I'll try and keep this as brief as possible. The co-host role is probably how our audience perceives my role, but that's actually a very small piece of it. The show is typically just over an hour in length, so recording it takes just over an hour a week. Once we finish recording, our partner over at Fractal Recording takes a few hours to edit the audio, mix the music, and get the show ready for release. Then I proof listen to make sure there are no glaring editing mistakes and release the show. Releasing the show consists of a few steps to post a description on the Macro Voices website, which I usually do while Fractal Recording is editing the audio. Then I release the show to our iTunes feed and send out a tweet announcing that the show is up and ready. Finally, I create a topic in our listener discussion forum to provide listeners with a place to discuss what they've heard. But the real work of the producer job is in recruiting the feature interview guests. Now, we strive for high-demand guests who aren't the easiest to get a hold of. Most of them have assistants screening our calls and emails, and so getting their attention is more of an art than a science. Some of our best guest interviews have been people we had to invite several times before they even responded or noticed our invitations. It definitely requires patience and persistence. I also curate the research roundup emails. Virtually 100% of the articles come from my perusing the internet, so this job definitely fits with someone who eats and sleeps markets and reads voraciously like I do. All in all, I'd estimate I typically spend around 15 to 20 hours a week on Macro Voices, including all the production-related tasks, guest recruiting, schedule coordination with Eric via email, and so forth.
So, listeners, I'm looking for someone, preferably a longtime regular listener to the show, who's interested in taking over Aaron's responsibilities. If you're interested, please email me at info@macrovoices.com and let me know a little bit about yourself, why this interests you, and what you would expect to get out of it.
Again, that email address is info@macrovoices.com. Now, based on my own experience, you know, I learned a tremendous amount, both personally and professionally, from producing and co-hosting Macro Voices, and I hope the next guy, or gal, has the same great experience I've had. But Eric, you also told me off the air that you're considering the future direction of the show for other reasons. So let's also bring our listeners up to speed on that. What's on your mind here?
Well, I've really enjoyed producing this show for most of a year now. For some reason I can't describe, really. I just find financial journalism is fascinating and personally rewarding to me. And to be sure, as a fund manager, I do have an ulterior motive here. I get to pick the brains of the smartest people on earth every week, and I learn something from every interview that helps to shape my market view. So I really do enjoy doing this, but frankly, it costs a lot more than I expected it was going to when we launched this thing. And to produce the show like this is expensive. So admittedly, I could do it on a smaller budget if I compromise quality. Chris Curran at Fractal Recording is the best of the best in the podcast production business. But frankly, he knows he's the best of the best, and he's not shy about expecting to be compensated at a premium rate for his premium talent. Chris edits out all of our mistakes, mixes the music, and turns the whole thing around in a few hours' time every single week so that we can air the show literally just 3 or 4 hours after we tape our market wrap. That's what it takes to deliver a show of this production quality on a timely schedule, and it doesn't come cheap. So let me just cut right to the chase. The bottom line here is that while I don't want or need to make a profit from this, I can't justify continuing to reach into my own pocket and spending thousands of dollars a month just for the privilege of being able to work hard to produce this show every week and then give it away for free as a hobby. Now, as I admitted a minute ago, there's definitely a benefit to me as a money manager to be able to pick the brains of the smartest people in finance every single week. But I just can't justify the out-of-pocket expense to continue indefinitely on the path that we've been on. So what I really need to do is recruit a sponsor, someone who's willing to cover the production costs in exchange for promotional consideration. But I really want to avoid disrupting the flow of the show with commercials or anything like that. So here's my sales pitch to prospective sponsors. Wall Street Week with Lewis Rukeyser was made possible by a grant from MFS, providing services to mutual funds and other institutional investors. Listen, folks, that quote was from memory, and it was from 35 freaking years ago when I used to watch Wall Street Week as a teenager. So that classy, understated style of marketing really is effective. And I'm pretty sure, by the way, that that quote is accurate word for word, and that's from memory 35 years later. So my ideal solution would be to find a sponsor who will foot the bill for production costs in exchange for bookending the show with a tasteful promotional announcement along the lines of what Wall Street Week used to do. But I really don't want to disrupt the format with commercials during the show or having to endorse some sponsor's product personally. I use it myself. You should too. You know, let's try to keep it away from anything cheesy, please. Bottom line, my request to our listeners, please think about who you know in your professional network that might be in a position to sponsor Macro Voices and let them know about the opportunity. I really need to do something so that I don't have to continue to reach into my own pocket in order to produce this show every week.
Okay. To sum that up, production costs are more than you can justify paying to continue producing the show out of the goodness of your heart without any revenue. And the ideal solution is a sponsor who is willing to keep us afloat in exchange for promotional exposure, so long as it's done in a tasteful manner without screaming sales pitches for their product disrupting the show. Now, I'm confident you'll find that sponsor, Eric, and I've gotten some solid feedback from some of our guests about the promotional benefit they've derived from appearing on Macro Voices, and our listener download counts are growing in leaps and bounds. But if the ideal sponsor doesn't step up to the plate, what other options are you considering?
Well, I really want to avoid going to a paid subscription model if at all possible. I want Macro Voices to stay free of charge to listeners. So I suppose the obvious alternative would be to compromise the quality in favor of lower production cost. You know, we could just totally skip the market wrap and all the other commentary and just do the guest interview alone every week with me and the guest and no co-host. That would reduce the audio production cost significantly. But frankly, it wouldn't be the same show if we did it that way. And so I'd like to avoid that if I possibly can. In fact, what I'd really like to do is go the opposite direction and make some upgrades that I have in mind to the show format that would bring more voices to the show each week. But those changes would actually increase production costs, not decrease them. So that's, you know, completely out of the question without some kind of sponsorship. The other obvious path would be to add, you know, advertising or some other monetization tactic, you know, to sell the show or something like that. I'd really prefer to avoid that if I possibly can. But frankly, beyond that, I'm fresh out of ideas.
Well, Eric, our audience includes a lot of incredibly smart people. So how about this? Why don't we start a thread in our listener discussion forum at www.macrovoices.com/forums and brainstorm the issue with our listeners?
Now, that's a fantastic idea. So why don't we do this? I will post a thread. I'll title it Making Macro Voices Break Even in the Listener Discussion Forum as soon as this episode airs. And I'll lay out the problem and some of the other solutions that I've considered. And I'll try to go into a little bit more detail than we had time to discuss on the air here.
All right. Well, sounds good. Eric, we're out of time. Anything else you want to add before we close?
Our regular listeners have heard it before. We so much need your help. If you want to continue to hear some of the fantastic guests that we've had lately on the program and people of that caliber, we need your help promoting the show. So please retweet us when we announce the show on Twitter. Forward your Macro Voices research roundup emails to your friends and colleagues to help spread the word. And most importantly, please register your free account at macrovoices.com. The number of registered users we have is the statistic that's most effective in recruiting these high-profile guests and getting them on the program. And of course, the benefit of registration is you get our free research roundup email every week, which is a compendium of the very best content that Aaron could find on the internet every single week. What do we got for him this week, Aaron?
Well, this week's research roundup includes the latest speeches from Mervyn King at the American Museum of Finance and Kenneth Rogoff at the Royal Society. Now, these videos are interesting, not necessarily because you agree or disagree with them, but because they are thinkers who have outsized influence over existing and future monetary and economic policies. Next, we've got a bubblicious slide deck from Asilon Capital Partners' latest market update. You'll definitely want to sit down and spend some time with this chart book. And finally, the Wall Street Journal published an interesting article that relates the macro to the micro and tells the story of a German nun turned trader who, upon figuring out what swaps were, moved quickly to sell her Deutsche Bank shares. You also get some insights into Sister Lioba's thinking on the negative interest rate environment, risk management, and position sizing. You'll find all this and much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we've gotten and continue to welcome your suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For our listeners who write or blog about global markets and would like to share that content with our pro-finance community, shoot us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag and we'll include it in our weekly distribution. If you haven't already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for the latest updates and interview releases. You can also follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Macrodidact. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chen. Chat with you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.